Next item on the agenda is Shoreland Investments LLC. Notice of violation number 07-25. Mr. Badger, good morning.
Good morning. I'll try to be brief. Okay, Shoreland Investment LLC, Mr. Willie Davis is the manager, and Newman Scott is the boat captain. Notice of violation 7-25, and this is a hearing concerning violations of Chapter 12, Subtitle 3 of 28.2 Code of Virginia, more specifically, an unauthorized dredging and filling of two small unnamed title tributaries in Underhill Creek adjacent to Fort Scarborough Subdivision in Accomack County, and this was continued since from the November 27th Commission meeting. I've got a slide. It's a quad sheet showing in the circle Underhill Creek. To your left is the Chesapeake Bay, US 13, town of Anancock is here, Punkatick Creek. A little closer view of Underhill Creek. In circle is the two tributaries that were crop dredged, and the subdivision itself that goes back here. It's about 33 acres, and this is a 10-lot subdivision. All 10 lots supposedly are riparian lots. We received a notice from a nearby property owner that a workboat was creating a channel to appear at the headwaters of one of these small creeks in Underhill, one small tributaries in Underhill Creek. We flew over the project on June 18th and observed and photographed two areas that had been illegally dredged. Dredged material appeared to be moved to by the boat prop and distributed on and cast to each side of the existing channel. And this is the first photograph. You can see this here. Here's a small pier here, and you'll see later in a survey that we did that we felt like the dredging came all the way out to here. And on the other side, you can see a small pier, and that's the other tributary that was dredged. And here's the other tributary and the small and the workboat that I believe did the dredging. The dredging starts here and continues on out the creek here in the subdivisions in this general area. We turned the photographs and the location of the unauthorized dredging and filling of state-owned Swagless Bottom over to VMRC law enforcement staff for action. Officer David Drummond investigated the complaint and charged the operator of the boat, Newman Scott, and the manager of Shoreland Investment, Mr. Willie Davis, with violations of Section 28.2.1203 of the Code of Virginia, which is the unlawful use of Swagless Bottom, a Class 1 misdemeanor. The two cases were heard in Accomack County General District Court on October 3rd of this year. Both Mr. Scott and Mr. Davis pleaded guilty and were found guilty as charged. Each was fined $250 plus court cost. After they were convicted on October 23rd of this year, we submitted a sworn complaint and notice of violation was issued for the unauthorized dredging and filling of the two small unnamed tidal creeks. We did not afford Mr. Scott or Mr. Davis the opportunity to submit an after-the-fact application in light of the fact that this type of activity would not normally ever have been approved by the commission. I'll go through some of these slides. This is a 2001 aerial. As you can see, the two guts or tributaries. You don't see any channels going up in here on either side at this point. Again, this is a little closer view, and this is my rendition in red of the two piers that are built and existing now. And this is the approximate edge of where the dredging, prop dredging, stopped. A little closer view, you can still see no channels on either side here. The next one is a Google photograph, and it's not as clear as these. And it looks like it must have been taken in sometime late May of 07, because as you can see, now we have a dredged channel in here. It's not quite to the pier, and on this side, the dredged channel stops before the pier. So I'm making the assumption that the prop dredging had not finished at this point on here. And this is our survey that we did at low tide on October 30th. We checked the charts. The charts said it was supposed to be an average low tide. We checked the real-time gauges around the Chesapeake Bay, and it confirmed it. So these are relatively accurate mean low, approximate mean low watermarks and elevations. As you can see, it's a 600-foot long channel here, 600-foot long channel here. It's approximately 20 feet wide. Depths range from 2.1 there at 2.6 in the channel, and up by the dock on the other side, it's 1.4, and it comes out to about 2.9. There's mudflats from here back from the filling of subaqueous bottoms on both sides from the prop dredging, and there's still small, only 0.2 feet on both sides of the channel here. So it's dropping off 2 feet in this channel area on both sides. When we did the calculations on this, the area that was impacted from the dredging and the filling is approximately 72,000 square feet or 1.65 acres. That's from the fill areas on both sides and the dredge. Now, this is only approximate because we didn't have contours prior to the dredging itself. So this is the best we could come up with. And by doing that, the total volume was approximately 1,714 cubic yards of material that was flowing to the sides. Projects completed without a permit are constructed in a manner other than authorized by the VMRC permit are illegal and may be subject to prosecution both criminally and civilly. In lieu of seeking civil penalties, the Commission may also consider civil charges in the amounts not to exceed $10,000 for each violation. In the event that the Commission and the applicant cannot agree on a civil charge, the case can be forwarded to the State Attorney General's office with a request that they seek the appropriate civil penalties. The maximum penalties may be reached up to $25,000 per day for each violation if upon finding by the appropriate civil court. Also, according to the Attorney General's office, this is not a case of double jeopardy since one is criminal and one is civil. The criminal case has already been decided civil now. Mr. Davis is the manager of Shoreland Investments, LLC. Mr. Scott either works for or is under contract to Shoreland Investments. And Shoreland Investments, best I can figure, appears to be owned by MLC Real Estate 202 LLC. And MLC is based out of Brookville, Wisconsin, and owns the property at Port Scarborough. And Port Scarborough, as I said earlier, is a 10-lot subdivision. And off their website, size of the lots range from 1.9 to 11.9.
Is that 1.1 or 1.9?
I'm sorry, 1.1.
Okay, thank you,
sir. And the lot prices on their website range from $369,000 to $599,000. That's off their website. What they would sell for, don't know. In our survey, I'm going to back up one. No, I'll stay here. In our VMR survey, lots 1, 2, and 3, and 8, 9, and 10 have very limited water access before the channel was created. We figure it's somewhere between 4/10 and 6/10, and I think that's being very generous, particularly when you get all the way up to the headwaters up here. I personally believe if we'd had a survey before it, it may have been even intertidal, but I have no proof to that. So we're assuming that it's subaqueous bottom. After the unauthorized dredging of the two channels, these two lots now have access to, or these six lots now have access to approximately 2 feet of water at low tide. And in other words, the illegal dredging would appear to have created greatly increased the accessibility and therefore the value of these six lots. Let's see if I've got some ground shots here. This is the one to the west. And you can see that this is at approximate low water, same day we did the survey.
The PVC pipe that's there?
Yes.
Can you speculate on, or do you have personal knowledge as to who placed that there and for what effect it was placed there?
I do not. I assume it's there to mark where they were dredging. I see no other reason for it to be there. The channel is where the PVC pipe is all the way out. Again, a little closer view. And this is only what we can see. And as I said, it's 600 feet on each one, so there is more dredging. This is the other side, and you can see the workboat still docked there. Channel and PVC comes out to about here, and this is where the dredging stops. And I'll just leave this up and continue on. Accomack County was advised of the violation, and they did not take jurisdiction since the majority of it was subaqueous. Although there, some of the areas now gone intertidal, this was created as a result of illegal activity that arose from state bottom. So this intertidal area is still state-owned wetlands now. VIMS has indicated that the activity has resulted in significant impacts to wetlands resources. The method of dredging used most certainly resulted in increased turbidity and suspended sediment loads well over the traditional methods. In addition, the side casting material is contrary to what would be recommended for any dredging project and has resulted in increased secondary impacts from the unpermitted activity. It is also reasonable to assume, given that the relatively undeveloped nature of the surrounding riparian areas and the presence of vegetated wetlands along the shoreline, that the dredging activity has disrupted a fairly diverse and productive mudflat and shallow water habitat. While the recovery time for organisms likely present in this productive community is unknown at the present time, it may easily take years to recover. Given the opportunity, VIMS would have recommended against the dredging of wetlands to create navigational depths, and it is unlikely that they would have recommended dredging in this area regardless of the method. Both DEQ and the Army Corps have been notified of the violation. Whether or not they'll proceed and address this issue will be up to them. Our summary and recommendation, the adverse impacts to subtidal tributaries of Underhill Creek caused by the prop dredging are considerable. In our subaqueous guideline, the overboard disposal of dredged material into tidal waters is generally not permitted, and the side casting of dredged material would only be authorized under exceptional conditions. As stated by VIMS, this method of dredging used most certainly resulted in increased turbidity and suspended sediment loads over traditional methods. Had staff had the opportunity to evaluate the project, we would not have recommended approval of this dredging method. I'm only familiar with the Army Corps being able to use overboard disposal, and the only other case that I've seen was at the mouth of Nassauwax Creek from 3 months ago, and that was not silt and mud, that was sand material, and not at the volume that we're dealing with here. So they're the only methods I've seen of overboard disposal in the past. Mr. Davis and Shoreland Investments have in the past 3 years applied for and received private pier permits from the MRC for lots 1, 7, and 10. I don't want that. They also applied for and received a permit from the MRC to hydraulically dredge an entrance channel adjacent to their Coburn Hall subdivision along Chincoteague Bay back in 2005. Therefore, staff does not believe that they could reasonably assume that the amount of disturbance to these environmentally sensitive areas would not have required additional authorization from the same agencies that they had worked with in the past. Unfortunately, staff believes that any attempt to restore the non-vegetated subaqueous lands and associated mudflats to their original contours would only result in more disturbance over time. If left to fill in naturally, the area should slowly recover and return to their natural pre-disturbed elevations. In this case, staff believes it is appropriate to view these cases as constituting at least 4 to 6 separate violations. This would include the unauthorized dredging of 2 separate cove areas and the dredging of this side and that side and the adjacent filling along both sides of the 2 dredge cuts. As such, a civil charge, if considered deemed appropriate, considering the major degree of deviation, major degree of noncompliance and significant environmental impacts, civil charges of $40,000 to $60,000 would seem to be appropriate in lieu of any further enforcement action, especially concerning the potential increase in the value the lots have accrued as a result of the illegal activity. Should this not be deemed a significant environmental or economic penalty, staff would recommend this matter be referred to the Attorney General's office to seek civil penalties of up to $25,000 per day for the separate violations. The dredging itself appears to have occurred over a two-week period, although the violation and impacts continue today. We would also recommend that the Commission clearly state its intent to allow these impacted areas to return to their pre-dredge contours and elevations prior to entertaining any new application to dredge or maintenance dredge in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Badger. Any questions of Hank from staff? Mr. Schick.
And to allow the felicitation of it to fill back in, are you, if these lots build piers and they put boats at it and they continue to use this channel as a egress, ingress, whatever, it will be difficult for it to fill in. So is there a way to recommend that these lots cannot put piers out, or how would that work?
If I owned a lot, I'd make sure I kept it open. Now that it's open,
mm-hmm.
I would make sure my boat came in and out of there enough times. There's no question about that. You have the right, if you're a riparian owner, to build out to navigable water. So I'm not real sure how we can control a private pier going out to that small channel that's been
even though the navigable water was made through illegal activity.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't know how we.
The only way to correct that is for us to fill it.
Yeah.
Or cause it to be filled. Mr. Fox?
Hank, why were the two piers that are existing, why were they approved when there was really no water?
It's real simple. It's a private pier. They're exempt from us. No permits required. As long as they meet the minimum qualifications, which is the width and the square footage of the T-heads or appendages, a lot
so
of piers.
Build a pier to nowhere.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If it's.
I think the General Assembly contemplated when they passed the NPN rule that common sense would prevail, that the average person wouldn't build one to nowhere, but sometimes they did.
Unless they make the somewhere.
And truth be known, you could launch a kayak at mid-tide.
Right.
There.
Right.
So, there is some use that could be used from this.
Okay. Mr. Robbins and Mr. Tankard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hank, just to follow up on the proposed civil charge in your staff assessment, would that be against the LLC? And if so, what about Mr. Davis and Mr. Scott?
Mm-hmm. We've talked about that, and I think that's going to have to be left up to y'all how you want to do it. It's my understanding, and Mr. Davis and Mr. Scott are here, and they're represented, that Mr. Davis is the manager for the LLC. So I'm assuming that the LLC would be the one that would be hit with the civil charge.
But the bottom line is, if you assess it against the offending individual, where it comes from is then up to the offending individual. Mr. Tankard?
Yes, two questions, if I could, sir. First thing I see when I read your narrative here is that looks like a lot of tax dollars spent, a lot of time. Can you put up a plane, and when you do all this, you got any feeling how much time you spent, et cetera, on this for us?
We spent, Paul Rogers did the survey for us, and I spent a day in the field, probably another day in the office, so 2 days there. For the evaluation, I'm always spending time. We went to court, and Officer Drummond is here also. He spent numerous days and hours getting the court case prepared, so it was quite a bit.
It's almost as though your fine that you propose this would just go a little bit towards covering your time, perhaps. But the other thing is the criminal activity. You mentioned 2 weeks of dredging. Is that 5 days a week, or is that a 7 day a week thing?
I really don't know. We weren't there when it was happening. Officer Drummond may have some better understanding.
I'm going to put him under oath here shortly and ask him a few questions that may clarify that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, sir. And it's my understanding, just one other thing, and that the boat itself originally was registered to someone from Tangier or Smith Island, and it has been changed over and registered now under the LLC. Now, Mr. Davis may be able to tell us if that's really the case, but I believe the LLC actually owns the boat now.
Dr. McConaughey, then a follow-up, Mr. Schick.
Yeah, given you showed some pictures there where the channel had been partially dredged and then later on was completed, wouldn't that indicate more than just six violations?
Well, I wasn't there, so it's hard to speculate,
but I mean,
I'm making the assumption that they were still working on it. I believe that probably right there is the boat, the little white spot right beside the pier, and that they were working on it, and this picture happened to be while they were just continuing. I don't think that they stopped and started, but it probably took them a couple weeks.
Mr. Schick?
As far as the per day, $25,000 per day, now the two-week period is when they actually did the damage, but could that also continue beyond that because of continuing activity in that area?
I think that would be a question for Carl.
Right.
I really don't know.
Mr. McCleskey.
If the applicant had made a formal application to the BMRC to hydraulically dredge that creek with an appropriate disposal area, would the commission have considered that?
We would have had to consider it if it was an application. It would have been in front of you because I suspect when you saw the contours normally off the vegetated wetlands, it's a 4-to-1 ratio, that it would have had to have been narrower because once you get up there, it's real tight. VIMS would have recommended not to dredge that far up into the headwaters of these small coves. So I think it would have been in front of you with a staff's recommendation for denial of at least a good portion of both sides. Yeah.
Thank you.
Further questions? Officer Drummond?
Any particular slides you would like left up?
That's fine. You solemnly swear the testimony that you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, self you God.
I do.
Can you give us somewhat of an overview, date, what your personal observations of what you saw, and if the individual that you subsequently interviewed and charged is here today, I'd like to have that, sir.
Yes, sir. When I first got the complaint from, which came from Mr. Badger, or
step up for the microphone, over this way to the mic. Thank you.
The best that we could determine was last week of May to the first week of June, and that was according to Mr. Scott, who is here and was charged. That's the best thing we could put together. Plus, from the nearby residents, it was hard to come up with an exact date, but it was, like I said, approximately the last week of May, first week of June. And also, according to Mr. Scott, it was 4 or 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. And as far as the amount of time, it varied with the tide. There's a little water at high tide and virtually none at low tide.
Did he indicate to you what his purpose was? And although it may have seemed obvious, did he indicate what he was doing and why? And who consigned it?
Well, Mr. Scott is basically an employee of Shoreland Investments, LLC. It was discussed between Mr. Davis and Mr. Scott. Mr. Davis was interested in purchasing a larger boat for showing properties to prospective buyers. So Mr. Scott found a Beverly Joy, which was a work boat from Tangier. I believe it was Mr. Parks that owned it. But anyway, Mr. Davis asked Mr. Scott if he could run the boat. And, of course, he agreed. There was no problem there. They went over, got the boat. He did ask Mr. Davis where he wanted to keep the boat. And, of course, he said at Port Scarborough there at the dock. Mr. Scott told him that it was probably going to be an issue there as far as not having enough water. That he probably wouldn't be able to get in there. In fact, he even commented that he had crabbed in that creek. And, you know, he knew for a fact that a lot of times, even with a small outboard, he had to work with the tide, you know, to even get his crab pots up. Then there was a brief discussion between Mr. Davis and Mr. Scott on what could be done to make it deeper. It was discussed about using the Beverly Joy to basically blow out the two guts. Of course, there was a brief discussion. Mr. Scott said you can certainly do that, and that's what led to the using the boat to basically dredge the two channels.
Where does Mr. Scott reside? Where was his
residence?
Anancock. In Anancock?
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Davis?
He has a Hornetown address. I'm not sure if that's where he resides or if that's it's an area called Corbin Hall, which is basically developers.
Mm-hmm. Now, when they went to court, you testified in court to basically what you testified to here today, or did you?
They pled guilty. I didn't have to testify to anything.
There's no testimony in court?
Mr. Polson was representing them in court, and to our surprise, they pled guilty.
Okay. Further questions of the officer? So, Mr. Tankard?
I'm sorry to add dollars and cents again. How much time have you spent on this, Mr. Drummond?
It's probably about a week, but that, it wasn't 8 hours a day. Some of the problems I have is getting up with the some of the witnesses, trying to catch them home. And I believe I talked with Mr. Scott and Mr. Davis at least twice each. So it was roughly a week, but it wasn't, like I said, 8 hours a day. I'd say total probably 25, 30 hours.
Okay. Can you point to Mr. Scott and Mr. Davis?
There's Mr. Scott.
Okay.
Just raised his hand.
Uh-huh.
And Mr. Davis is seated to his right.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Officer Drummond. Mr. Polson? Good morning, sir.
How are you doing?
Fine, sir.
Hey, put up second urn, if you will, please.
For the record, this is Mr. John Polson. He's an attorney admitted by the Virginia State Bar, known to me.
John Polson,
correct.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
A partner with Polson, North, and Lewis, and Accomack. And I represent Shoreland Investment and Newman Scott, Jr. Let me very quickly...
Put your microphone over
there. Yeah, help. Thank you, sir.
Let me very quickly, from the beginning... indicate to you that we're here in the status or state of trying to look for a reasonable compromise resolution of this particular matter. You know, that's the way we come before you. And I'd like for you folks to come on up, if you will. Recognize your time situation. I appreciate your time situation, but obviously this is an important thing to us, and we want to put out some facts to you. Mr. Davis is here. Mr. Scott is here. Dickie Hickman is here. Kendall Bradley, and also Chuck Rodley, which many of you probably will know.
Will they be testifying?
They will. Well, I'm going to try to cut it short. I'm going to represent what they're going to say, many of them, and simply ask them to affirm, is that correct?
They're going to do that. All they need to be sworn, so we have the signal. Do it all at once. Raise your right hand. You solemnly swear the testimony that you'll give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God. Thank you.
Let me quickly point out, you know, sometimes the word developer is a bad word. I have mixed feelings about developers myself. If we're going to have development on the shore, at least let it be done right. And I can mention some that I don't think do it right. Mr. Tank,
they're not before the commission.
I'll go
right
no
now,
further. These particular people, MLG, what they have done in Accomack County has been done extremely well. You see blacktop roads, you see entrance gates with limited access and codes to get in, things of that particular nature. Even on this particular property, you see two holding ponds there that they have kept, that they have created on this property, probably 1,000 Canada geese in there on Sunday morning, to say the least. They have had other permits at Corbin Hall, and I take that a little bit different than my friend Mr. Badger does. This showed to me that when they thought they had to have a permit, they went ahead and got a permit. You look at their dock permits for this particular thing, three private docks. They are well done. They are basically tight. They look good. Each one is about 50 feet long, these docks. They're not docks running clean out to the channel, which is, I think, of great significance. So like I say, basically they do things and try to do things in a correct way. They don't rape the land as oftentimes as the expression goes. Insofar as staff reports, and this is where we differ on the facts in this particular case. And with all due respect to my good friend Hank, I think there are some significant factual inaccuracies in staff's report. I think there are some unsupported assumptions, and I think perhaps it creates the wrong perspective of this whole situation. When you read the notice of violation here, it starts off with developer hired a boat. That has a certain connotation to come in and dredge. That's not true. The hired boat dredged two 600-foot channels alongside the subdivision. The water went from 0.4 of a foot at low tide to 2.9 feet at low tide. That is not correct. There was an intent to create water access for lots where none existed before. First time I ever heard that's when I read in staff report. Nobody had ever mentioned that, Mr. Drummond or anybody else, in any discussions that he and I had. And then it goes further and says, as a consequence, greatly increase the accessibility of the lots and thus the value of the lots. And then they tell you listed values are $369 to $599, and that's the justification for these large civil charges. Basically, on the violations, they get six violations out of this: dredge, dredge, fill to the right, fill to the left, which I think is more of a what we call a legal fiction than looking at the thing as a practical matter. Obviously, nobody is trying to fill anything here, left, right, or whatever. I think what you have is potentially two violations when it comes right down to it, realistically.
How about $25,000 per day of activity, Mr. Olson?
Well, that's not before us. What is before us is civil charges in which they're recommending parting $60,000.
Okay.
The factual background, Dickie Hickman's here. Dickie Hickman probably knows more about these two codes than probably any living soul in that particular area, unless he had quite some age on him. Dickie would tell you that his grandmother owned what is called the Moore Farm up on the right-hand side of the picture, which would be to the north. His grandmother's sister owned this particular property, which was called Betty's Cove. Dickie played around there for years from the time that he was a young boy. Of great significance, which staff has not mentioned and doesn't give any cognizance to, is the house on the right, which is on the Moore Farm, which is owned by Jimmy and Glenna, his wife, Parkers, related to the Moore people. You will see a dock there. That dock has been there for years. It is 2 feet at mean low water. It has been at least 2 feet there at mean low water for as many years as anybody can remember. It has always been accessible by outboard. Above Jimmy's, from that point there up to the dock, it was approximately 1 to 1.5 feet at mean low water at medium tides. Jimmy Parker, over on the right, in talking to Jimmy the other night, Jimmy said, please convey to the commission that I've always had 2 feet of water there at mean low tide. And please tell the commission, don't come and fill in anything. And basically, that's what Jimmy's message was to you. Dickie put the two docks in on 1 and 10. He did it by water. He used a pontoon boat with a long shaft outboard, and we know what a long shaft outboard draws. Staff tells you there was no channel there. There has always been a channel there coming up there, at least to the area where the point is above Jimmy's house. You have to know how to get into the channel, And this is where the PVC pipes, and you can see some of them in there, were put in there basically to mark the channel. This is totally different than someone cutting a channel out 600 feet long. In the area from the boat out to that point out there is probably about 450 feet, just to give you some perspective. These lots are about 150 feet wide. And I can, this is what Dickey would say, and if you'd like to verify that with him, Mr. Commissioner, he'd be happy to so indicate. The docks themselves, the three docks, and Hank and I have a little disagreement over terminology on the three docks. No, they're not permitted by BMRC as such, but they are, in effect, permitted by the Commonwealth of Virginia under the same section as 1203 by law. BMRC does look at them. They are for riparian owners. So, and the drawings show water up there. As I said, Dickey went up there, put the docks in by water, and indicates a foot and a half on low tide. So we're not talking about barren ground up there. In 2005, and let me go back to these docks, which I think is significant. These docks are only 50 feet long. If somebody was trying to cut a channel to access the lots, you can best believe they'd come up underneath the lots and not be looking at 50-feet docks, which technically don't go out to the channel. Again, just a matter of common sense, I'd suggest to you. Now, Newman Scott, Newman is a waterman. Basically, he works for MLG. The docks were built by Dickey. In 2005, Newman actually moored his boat up at the dock there. His dock or his boat was normally moored on a Nancock Creek with another waterman there. He was doing some work. He brought his boat around and moored it up there temporarily to the work that was done on his dock that he was using on a Nancock Creek. Newman got his boat up there. I'm not going to tell you he got up there on low tide, but he did get his boat up there. Let me offer some comments at this point. This situation, I guess the best word to use is somewhat intrigued me. Virginia Tidal and Coastal Law, Butler and Livingston, which is one of the horn books on that subject, under section 18.5, talks about the right of navigation and subaqueous lands. And basically, it takes the position that in navigating tidal waters, the public's right of navigation is paramount to all others, public and private rights. The state cannot significantly destroy or impair the right of navigation. Insofar as dredging, actually, they use the term for dredging as removal of materials from the bit. You may be aware that under 62.1, 190, and 193, a riparian owner, under certain circumstances, even has the right to dredge sand and gravel on state bottom if it's the continuation of sand and gravel on his particular property. I looked at 1203, and 1203 talks about unlawful to build, dump, trespass, or encroach upon, or take or use any materials. And I guess I looked at the word encroached, and, you know, what is encroached? Very easily could be this, frankly. So, you know, I gave consideration on that. The and let me point out a situation, and I thought Hank's comment was very interesting. Hank said, if I had a boat, what would I do? I'd go in and out of it. Wonder what Hank meant by that. And I think it comes down to this. Hank lives above me on Punkahdick Creek, and I live up further up Punkahdick Creek. And some years ago, I had a 33-foot Sea Ray. And, boy, that last leg was very difficult going up Punkahdick Creek. So a bunch of us in that particular area, we went out and we put us up some PVC pipes. And basically, we ran all the way out in places, out to Punkahdick Creek, to a bar on Pocatee Creek, which would be just westward of where Hank lives. And, you know, we did that for two reasons. Number one, we wanted Mark the best water. And number two, we were hoping that with some use of the creek, that we'd get a situation where we would improve the channel. There was a man named Mr. Ralston who lived above all of us, who had a work boat, and when he came out, we were tickled to death to see Mr. Ralston come out. But this is the way. This is Eastern Shore, I guess. This is what any of us that have a boat, any of us that live on a river or a creek or whatever, kind of recognize it. It's okay to do this, that you can take a boat, and as long as you don't have a dredge, as long as you're not tying the boat off with anchors or rope, which is the way you normally prop dredge, that as long as you're just running across, that it's okay to do that. So basically, you know, were we in violation for doing that? I don't know. I'm beginning to wonder. And this is what bothers me a little bit, that, you know, perhaps we are at least on part of this on a slippery slope, as the expression goes. And what actually happened here? Company bought a Tangier crab boat. Just as Mr. Drummond indicated, as they told him, the purpose was showing prospective buyers the property and the waters of Pocatee Creek and the property in general. It was a stable boat. It was a neat old boat, and, you know, that's the kind of thing impresses the tourists, so to speak, this Tangier work boat. And that's why they bought the boat. If they had intended to dredge this for the purpose of benefiting the lots, one would have thought that they would just use Newman's boat, which is the same size as this particular boat that they bought. Their whole intent here was to get to and use the docks, just as Mr. Drummond said. There was nothing sinister as dredging the cove, making the water deeper, and increasing the value of the lots. As Mr. Drummond indicated, as they told him, basically the question from Bill Davis was, Newman, can you get the boat to the two docks and around the property? Newman told him that he could. MLG, the actual owner of the property, was not involved in any way, shape, or form. They're up there in Wisconsin. This is a decision that was made basically on the property, just like if they make other decisions during the course of a day. They had the dock permits. There was no drag line involved. There was no hose involved. There were no anchors and ropes as one would normally prop dredge with. The only thing they did, they came up in the channel, the existing channel, which had been there for years, and basically came in with their boat. Dickey says that many years ago, his grandfather Moore, who was a farmer, actually moored a 40-foot fishing boat about where Jimmy's dock is. Now, obviously, that wasn't done with 4/10 of a foot of water. The criminal charges themselves, and let me back up just a minute. Again, no drag line, no hose, no anchors and ropes, in broad daylight. Nobody's trying to hide anything. And basically, you know, it comes down to a situation. We got a dock up there. Don't we have a right to go to our dock? You go out on the streets of the Eastern Shore of Virginia, and a lot of people are going to tell you, but you got a right to get to your dock, don't you? And that was what was in their mind at that particular time. The criminal charges. Only Bill and Newman were charged. You'll see a warrant notation on that, that the defense attorney did not agree that a violation of the statute had occurred. A little bit unusual to see that on a warrant, as the commissioner would know. They were no-low contenders, by the way. They weren't guilty pleas. They were no-lows. The Commonwealth's Attorney's Office was involved in the matter, and with a Class 1 misdemeanor, you can be talking about 12 months and $2,500 fine. Basically, a negotiated plea, a no-low, a fine of $250 each. One would have to think that the Commonwealth's Attorney did not view it as a grievous situation, so to speak. Commonwealth's Attorney lives on the same creek, by the way. As I noted, a lot of people are of the opinion that if you have a dock, as part of your riparian rights, you have the right to get to the dock. Now, that don't mean you bring the Queen Mary up. We fully concede that. But you do have a right to get to your dock. This particular boat had a 2-foot draft, much like my old Sea Ray, which had 26 inches. So the theory that we have dramatically created access to the creek where there were none and greatly increased the value of these high-priced lots, which are put at $599 maximum, which is lot 6, I would suggest to you that is not the facts at all. There was already channels of approximately 2 feet going up there. Jimmy Parker's lived there for years. As you get to the latter parts up there where you do see the side thing, a foot to a foot and a half in each case. Note that the channels were not cut under the shore, but basically they're in the middle of the cove where they had always existed. You couldn't reach those channels except by a dock of a lot of number feet, not the 50 feet that had been permitted. If you had 0.04 feet on low tide, you wouldn't even be able to get to them anyway, to these channels. Underhill Creek is shallow in itself. It is 8-board water property. It was before this, and this property is still 8-board water property. No lot has been sold since they've owned it, better than 2 years, and no lot was sold since Newman went to the docks. I have a letter, which I won't bother to introduce, but basically this is a letter from a realtor, which indicated lot 26, which you don't see, which is the best lot right on Underhill Creek. The highest offer for that particular lot has been $300,000, far cry from the $599 shown on the website as a listing price. Mr. Bradley is here, who is a real estate appraiser, who I want you to hear. Before that, I would like to pass out some photographs, if I may. Let's see if we've got enough. Yeah, they're all saying they're in order. And hopefully I've got enough for everybody. You look at the first one, this is looking to the basically north-northeast. On the right, you will see basically the path of the channel, which is the PVC pipes. Note that it doesn't run up underneath the shore. You will see the Parker house on the right. You see Jimmy Parker's boat, and then you see this work boat up in the left at the dock on lot 1. When you look at the second picture, this is kind of looking to the northeast. You will see, again, Jimmy's boat out there at his dock. You will see another dock right there around the point, which has a boat lift, of another property owner on the Moore Farm. You go to number 3, and this is at basically low tide or very close there, too. And again, you see Jimmy's boat, which he's moored on the inside of the dock there. Number 4 is looking out from the back of the boat at the dock on lot 1, and basically you see the channel as it goes out, again, not up underneath the land, but essentially right in the middle between the two bodies of land, which you would expect. The next one, which is dated 9/30/2007, again, you see the PVC pipes. Let me call to your attention. Over on the opposite shore, you will see a boat. If you come down a little bit, you'll see another PVC pipe, and I put a mark right underneath that PVC pipe, if you can see it. And the point of my doing that is this. This showed how the channel went, so to speak. It wasn't a straight channel. He bore out to the right over there. towards the Moore Farm, then had to come back between the PVC pipes. The next photograph, 9/30/2007, again looks out to the east where the channel was. You see the two PVC pipes out at the very end. Again, the next photograph again shows that little bar there with the PCB pipes off the end of that. And essentially, these photographs are pretty illustrative of the situation.
Who took the photographs for the record, Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Davis took them, or Mr. Scott, one of the others took them, I believe.
Who did?
One of the two did.
Mr. Commissioner, may I ask a question?
You sure may.
These pictures all seem to be of the east channel. Do you have any pictures of the west channel?
No, because my understanding at the time was they were talking basically about the what I'll call the north channel, Mr. Foster. That's the one we were looking at. We didn't take any of the other, and I did not ask to take any of the other, sir. Mr. Bradley is here, and I'd like for you to hear from Mr. Bradley. Many of you obviously will not know Mr. Bradley. Mr. Tanker will know Mr. Bradley. Mr. Holland will know Mr. Bradley. There are two real estate appraisers on the Eastern Shore who seem are in a class by themselves, Kendall Bradley and Rick Matthews. Kendall was the county assessor for many, many years, has been in the real estate business, appraising again for many years, has testified in many cases in both our circuit courts, and has testified on behalf of the Commonwealth before. And I'd like for him to address the issue, if I may, of what effect, if any, what has happened here has on the value of these lots and what these lots are actually worth.
Very briefly, please.
Thank you. I did analysis of...
What's your name, please, for the record?
Kendall Bradley. I did an analysis of sales in Accomack County waterfront properties going back 2 years. Based on that analysis, the value range of these lots would be in the $200,000 to $450,000 range. The $450,000 is for the prime lot number 6, which there is no market substantiation for a higher value for that particular parcel. As far as the enhancement of value due to the cutting of the channel to a greater depth, I'm operating under the assumption that all these lots had water access to begin with. So it's not a change in kind or character. It's evidently a change in degree. Given that fact, the impact... would be fairly minimal, can't be quantified precisely, obviously, but if you ask any buyer, would they rather have 1 foot deeper water access, they're going to say yes. However, how much would they be willing to pay for that when they already have access on most tides? You're not talking about extremely valuable land here. You're talking about guts on each side. You're talking about a remote location. This is not a prime subdivision. So my analysis is maybe you could get a little higher price if you really pressed it, but not everybody that buys a lot is a boater. A lot of people like view. It's very difficult to quantify, but you're not looking at a huge value increase based on what has been done here, given the assumption that you already had water in there.
Mr. Schick.
Now, given the assumption that you didn't have water, that you could only get a kayak or, some type of, shallow draft, non-motorized vessel, out. What would that do?
Okay, first of all, you're talking about mean low water depths, as I understand it. I mean, did they have 6 inches at mean low, or did they have what the old heads are saying, 1.5 or 2? You're still having water on certain tides, high tide or whatever you can get at. And that's a very common situation on the Eastern Shore, is not to have water at all tides. So, if the question is you either have water access or you don't have any water access, then common sense would tell you that could be a very significant difference. That's not the way I understand it, what occurred here.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you, sir. Mr. Paulson.
Now, Chuck Rodel is here. I don't know what Chuck wants to indicate anything or not. We asked Chuck to come over and just an instruction. Chuck, look at us and talk to us about it. So he can tell you what his own thoughts are.
My name is Chuck Rodley with Williamsburg Environmental Group, Mr. Commissioner, members of the commission. Mr. Paulson asked me to come over and give an independent assessment of the situation. He contacted me 3 or 4 days ago. I went over to the site, took a tour of it yesterday. Unfortunately, I can't disagree with a great deal of what's been said by staff with regard to the fact that there has been an impact. There has been the dispersion of sediment in the creek. The only empirical data that we have is staff survey of the area. You can see the areas in the shallows. It was low tide when I was out there. Maybe not been dead low because the wind was blowing, but you can certainly see the area in question. Mr. Paulson asked me if you know, what was the impact associated with this project. You know, these types of projects do have both temporary and can have long-term impacts depending on how deep they are. Certainly temporary sedimentation within the waterway, impacts to the flora and fauna, and those may recolonize over time, as staff has indicated, whether it's a short period of time or a long period of time. I don't know what the pre-existing condition was, so I can't gauge the relative difference in that time period. Mr. Scott took me out on the water in a small outboard, 17-foot outboard, and perhaps the most, I guess, significant observation I had when I was out there is that we navigated out from this pier and around to the other pier. And while we were in both channels, I noticed we were bumping bottom. This area remains a fairly shallow area as you get out, even when you cross beyond that sandbar that you see in the lower part of the photograph. And the other point I'd like to make is during the course of that boat ride, Mr. Scott earnestly was asking why what he had done was wrong in trying to provide access to that pier. And we all know why it's wrong, but I was somewhat moved by his comments in terms of his mindset in doing the action that was taken. I offer that only as an observation of the conditions as they existed when I was out on site. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions of Mr. Rodley? Mr. Fox?
So you're unable to say how long it will take for any damage that was done to be restored back to the state before? Did you estimate?
Well, to clarify, to restore, because I'm inferring it's not just repopulation of the flora and fauna, but it's actually restoring some elevation in there, and that would be dependent upon sedimentation rates in the vicinity of the project area, whether coming into it or just natural turbidity and the material falls out of suspension. And I can't comment on that. I mean, it could be 6 months, it could be 2 years.
Okay. But you would believe it would be in the 6 months to 2 years range?
I think from a flora and fauna standpoint, I don't know that you'd get sedimentation within 2 years that would bring it back up to pre-existing conditions. I mean, those areas, when they were farmed actively, probably contributed to the sedimentation within that creek, and now that they're not being farmed, it may take longer.
Further questions, Mr. Tankard?
So you mentioned that Mr. Scott said he was trying to provide access. So what you're saying to me is that it wasn't that he was just coming and going. He was working to increase the depth of the water in the channel that you saw and rowed your boat in. Is that correct?
He was, in deference to Mr. Paulson's comments, trying to gain access to the pier.
Right.
I'm not trying to put words in Mr. Scott's mouth.
Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you.
So let me basically just summarize. I think we need to look at the actual facts here, not look at assumptions, supposition, facts that somebody go out and basically on one day and check. You know, we brought you Dickie Hickman, who probably knows more about it than anybody on the situation. And basically, you got a situation, and I'm talking about the north side and I understand the south side is essentially about the same. Same water going in, more shallow water as you go up. But I think the crucial thing here, number one, is that there was already a channel there, at least as far up as to the point where the Parker house is. As I say, Mr. Parker's had a dock there for many, many years. The old 40-foot fishing boat of Grandfather Moore came in there and moored right against the bank many years ago. So there was an existing channel. Number two, I think it's, to me, I suggest very clear in this particular thing, that basically what they were trying to do was get to the dock. Nobody was trying to cut a channel to give greater access to these lots. You got low water all around there. You got low water out in the creek itself. You know, situation has not dramatically changed one way or the other. And again, I go back to this point of getting to your dock. And there may be a distinction between from the point on out, just like on the other side, and the point on up to the boat dock. But I don't believe, and as I say, we'd be getting on a mighty slippery slope here. If Jimmy Parker goes out on a low tide and he stirs up some sediment, if John Polson comes out Punkatee Creek with that sea ray, without putting old Shirley on the bow, so to speak, you know what that does. But, you know, that is a mighty slippery slope. You know, you talk to watermen and you talk to other people and they scratch their head and say, if you run aground or you can't get to your dock, you're committing a violation. You know, how much do the cruise ships turn up when they come into Norfolk, so to speak? So, and like I say, I think the whole bottom line here, and this has been what has been straight from the beginning, they were trying to get to the dock. Should they have tried to get to the dock from that point with this workboat, that's the one where I throw up my hands at, so to speak, and say perhaps not. But I do take great issue with anybody, quote, being in violation from the point on eight to the creek itself. So, again, I simply ask you to look at the facts as we respectfully suggest the facts are to you. We're not over here to fight, so to speak. We come in the manner that we hope we can resolve this thing with you in a reasonable way. It has been suggested, among other things, that grasses be planted in this non-vegetated area, and it was all non-vegetated, so to speak. We're certainly amenable to doing that. It has to be done at certain elevations, from what I understand. We have no difficulty doing that to stabilize it. Number two, we have no difficulty whatsoever in relocating the boat out of both coves. We have no trouble with selling the boat, frankly, if that's what the commission wants. But we can very easily agree that that boat will not come up in the coves anymore. So, you know, I just bring these things to your attention to show that, you know, we're trying to meet some accord with the commission on this issue.
Mr. Fox?
Question for Mr. Polson. Mr. Polson, I'm listening to your argument of getting to the dock. And with that argument in mind, why did you build the piers on lots 1 and 10 first instead of on lots 4 and 7, for example?
Lots 1 and 10 are somewhat different, Mr. Fox. Lots 1 and 10 are actually about 10 and 11 acres each, and they go all the way back to the road. But basically, by building the docks on these particular lots, basically somebody that would be coming out would in effect be able to see all the lots as you go around as opposed to building the dock on the point. So basically, you know, just a practical decision to build the docks there, to be able to see coming out, and to build the docks on 1 and 10. Basically, somebody looking at a lot already has a dock built, which does cost some money. And that was basically the reason.
Follow-up, Mr. Fox.
Yes.
you listed some of the things that you might be willing to do, mm-hmm. such as planting grass and so on. Would you be willing to convert these two existing docks into community piers and have no other piers on the property?
You mean a community pier for lot 2 and lot 1?
No, for all the lots.
I don't know that they'd be willing to do that. Haven't talked to them about it, about a community pier for all the lots. There is no area for a community pier, no area set aside. And I frankly have not discussed that with them.
Further questions?
And let me add on that, if I may, Mr. Fox. Even where I live, we have a very nice community pier. I spent a lot of time on that community pier trying to improve it and whatever. But everybody wants a dock, their own dock, including me. So you might have a community pier. Most time it's for internal lots, and most people say they want their own little dock that they go sit out on.
Mr. Rob,
or use or whatever.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just several follow-up questions with respect to some of the details of the case. Staff has indicated that the dredging project occurred over approximately 2 weeks. Can you tell us how long or how many days Mr. Scott dredged the area out?
I don't think anybody can elucidate on that. It wasn't the idea of we'll go down there every day between 9 and 5 and we'll take our boat and run up down the creek. Basically, he was working up at Carbon Hall, which is up county, and there would be times when he'd run down there depending on the tide or what he was doing, whether he had time to run down there to go in and out of the creek.
And in that case, just to follow up, how was he compensated? Was he compensated by the day, by the project, by the week?
He is paid by, how's he paid? He's paid by the hour, apparently.
Okay, and also another question on one of the players involved. Is Mr. Davis a member of the LLC, or is his compensation otherwise tied to the overall financial performance of the project?
He may answer that.
Mr. Davis.
No, I'm not a member of the LLC.
And the other half of that question was, is your financial compensation at all tied to the overall financial performance of the project?
No.
Thank you.
Mr. Tankard.
Mr. Coulson, a quick question. In your argument, you're sort of mentioning that people have a right to access and they should be able to move their boat to their dock. But these guys apparently pled guilty to the charges. So, in fact, is there some dispute about that guilty charge?
Yeah, I guess two or three things that pop out on that. You know, we live in a real world, so to speak. The commissioner knows where I'm coming from. Number one, it was a nolo contendere, a little bit different than a guilty plea. Number two, the fine was $250, reflecting how the Commonwealth viewed the situation. You know, these people theoretically could have gone to jail, and that, you know, that's some inducement. And then number three, I think it's significant that I had the court add to the warrant, which is most unusual, the fact that I had serious questions about whether it constituted a violation or not. And I go back primarily to getting up to the point, so to speak. And as I say, as I stand here right now, I think what we need to be looking at, frankly, is from the point on up to the dock, probably on both cases, because I don't think anybody, any court, would take the position that if you've got a lawful permit for your dock, which they had, and you're in your boat, and you choose to follow the same channel out all the time in the hopes that you're going to deepen that channel and make it easier to get to that boat, I don't think that's a violation of law. I really don't.
Mr. Tankard.
Is it okay if I ask Mr. Scott a question?
He's presented before you. Yeah, he sure is, and he's under oath. Mr. Scott, step to the podium, please.
Newman Scott, Jr.
Mr. Scott, just tell me a little bit about what you did on a daily basis to accomplish the depth. That
I just started where the dock will, where the boat tied up and just went out to Crete and come back. That was it.
One time?
Two, three times a day, maybe. because like, you can't go in an 8-hour all the time. Not with this, not with the tide.
How many days?
No more than 3-4 total.
Further follow-up?
No.
Further questions?
Let me add a point, too.
Could you stand at the mic?
Yeah.
Those who have been around the water are aware that you prop dredge by tying ropes or anchors off to the boat. None of that was done at any point.
Well, there's been a lot said what this is and what this isn't. And there's been a lot of justification, legitimization, different ways of doing business, be it on the Eastern Shore, be it otherwise. I live on the water as well, and we started back with the utilization of a pontoon boat with a long shaft prop, and I think that was intended to indicate that there are significant waters there, but if you put the long shaft prop on a pontoon boat that's significantly elevated, sometimes that's not a specific indicator how deep the water is. This case gives me serious concern. Normally, in my boat, when I get to the point where I'm run aground, I don't continue to go further. Under 28.212.03, Mr. Paulson, you quoted that section in trying to come to a conclusion as to what we were dealing with. That's, and I want to quote it, it shall be unlawful for any person to build, dump, trespass, to use the word encroach, but then it continues, upon or over, or take or use any materials from the beds of the bays, rivers, oceans, streams, or creeks, which are the property of the Commonwealth, and that's important, the property of the Commonwealth, unless such act is performed pursuant to a permit issued by the Commission, or is necessary for the following, and enumerates other things. Why this was done is in the eye of the beholder, the gentleman that is your real estate appraiser. Could not quantify. He was very honest, very forthcoming, as to what type of value increase that this would cause. And as I live on the water, I know that's in the eye of the beholder. My house might be assessed for X number of dollars, but whatever it's worth is what somebody will pay. We've heard in the report that significant damage has been done to this ecosystem. And the fact of, and going back to Hank's comment, I know what Hank meant, I do believe, and that is that once it's been done, in order to maintain the ability to use that thoroughfare that was ill-gotten to begin with, one would continue back and forth. I don't think Hank meant in his comments that was a common way that Hank would navigate the stream bed or the channel to continue on. If we, as a commission, start tacitly allowing these type of activities to be undertaken without oversight by the Commonwealth, where do we stop? The question we have, I think, here today is how significant a violation and what is the appropriate penalty for the violation? I understand your comments about court. I know that sometimes it's better to take a bird in the hand at a certain cost versus risking going into that bush and seeing what you might come out with. And I understand your comments pertaining to what the Commonwealth Attorney may have done. The Commonwealth Attorney determines a different thing than what the Commission does. They determine criminal guilt and what's the applicable fine for criminal guilt. And sometimes criminal guilt versus civil guilt or civil responsibility is different. So I don't assign a lot of significant merit to the fact that the Commonwealth Attorney fined him $250 in this case. The case was disposed of, a guilty plea or a conviction by whatever means was obtained. So having said that, the matter is before the Commission for deliberation and determination. Mr. Schick?
I do have a problem with the situation, and I'll tell you why. There's a difference between somebody who is running up a shallow creek with an outboard vessel and hitting bottom. And purposefully taking an inboard vessel that was never meant to go up a shallow channel and running back and forth, not to their own private dock, but to a corporately owned or LLC-owned dock. The comparisons are apples and oranges, and they're not valid in this situation. This situation is a LLC disturbing state-owned property without a permit, simple and clear. It's irreparable because when these lots sell, people will continue to use the deeper draft vessels because the precedent has been set. Now, for years, an outboard went up and down and did what it did, and that was fine. But now we've stepped it up. We brought out a stronger weapon. And as these lots get developed, this will continue. And I don't see the penalties that we've talked about here as far as $40,000 to $60,000 are near covering the damages done here. It won't even cover what we had to do to bring it to this point in time. If this had been done legally, which would not have been able to have gotten a permit, you're talking about over $100,000 it would have cost to do this. And there is significant impacts on the value of these lots compared to somebody who can launch a canoe to somebody who could launch a inboard outboard 26-foot boat. I just think that we need to take that into account.
Further comment, Mr. Tankard?
Sadly enough, one of the things that you know, coming from the shore, work boats on Tangier were a dime a dozen. Again, because the bay's almost dead, you can buy them everywhere. And here we have shore people enhancing the destruction of our waterways. And it's interesting, the tool they used was a Tangier water boat. People can hardly live over there anymore, make a living on the water. I see it as a two-week fine, $10,000 a day. I make a motion for a $200,000 fine.
Is there a second to the motion?
Second.
Second by Mr. Fox. Further discussion? Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've heard from our staff with respect to a summary of the facts, and then we've heard from the applicant's counsel that the applicant was simply trying to get to his dock. And I think to argue that this in some way was not a deliberate dredging of those guts is frankly not substantiated by the facts or by the record. And I think it's clear that it was an intentional dredging project. I agree that the fines that have been proposed by staff are on the low end. I think at $40,000 to $60,000, to the extent that these may have enhanced the values of six waterfront lots, at that level, it's simply a cost of doing business, potentially to the development community, and I think that's unacceptable. I can't support the motion for $200,000, but I think that it is appropriate to go beyond the civil charges that are contemplated in the staff assessment.
Oh. My concern, I'd like to echo that, and no deference to my colleague from Virginia's Eastern Shore. I respect where he's coming from. As a matter of fact, he's probably got a better perspective than anyone that's, well, including Mr. Holland as well. Mr. Bowden's not here. But I want to, as commissioner, ensure, and we were chastised a little bit about one which I thought was a significant fine that we levied recently for a similar type of violation. From a consistency perspective, I just want to ask my colleagues to recall the last one that we levied, and if you believe that this is significantly more egregious than the last one, then so be it. But I just want to make sure that we maintain some level of consistency as well in the application of our duties.
And the last one was at?
At $100,000 was the one that I was talking about.
Okay.
That's my concern. So, anyway.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to make a substitute motion.
Mr. Holland.
To have the fine at $100,000 be consistent with what we did the last time.
Is there a second to the motion?
Second.
Second by Mr. Robbins. Further discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Robbins first as seconder of the motion, then Mr. Tankard.
Thank you. I just want to ask the commission for, or if any members would like to address the issue of who should be involved. We've made a motion for a civil charge in this instance. Is it simply against the LLC, or are members planning on identifying also the operator, for example, Mr. Scott, and or the manager separately or jointly in this action?
I think the last one was against the LLC, and I think in order to be consistent that we should apply that as well. Now, if I turn out to be wrong, we do not have the benefit of counsel here today due to logistical problems, but we can always revisit it. Mr. Tankard?
I have 2 points. First, I guess, one, if my memory serves me correctly, the mowing of the marsh by the excavator, did we not find $10,000 a day in that? And if we didn't, my next point would be that we are dealing with two codes. So that's why I would also say two times the one rate. So that's how I would also justify the 200. And also, I think that there, and this is a new precedent. Maybe this is, I think the public is behind us. I had numerous people tell me in the last time we found, that's just not enough. The price of, you know, the lots that, if we're sold, I did a quick math on the lot, the asking price for these lots, $4.4 million for 33 acres. I mean, we're talking about chump change. Our fine on the price of these lots. So those are my points and my plea to the commission.
Okay. Substitute motion on the floor is $100,000 civil charge against the LLC. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Kathy, you want to call the roll? Or you want me to call the roll? Do you have one?
Aye.
No.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
Mr.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Mr. Robin?
Aye.
Nay.
Nay.
3 noes. 5.
5 aye. Motion passes. Now, this is a situation where I imagine you will have to talk with your client and decide whether they want to accept that civil charge in lieu of further action with the Attorney General's office. And what we'll do to keep from getting to that is we'll have Mr. Josephson get in touch with you and we can go from there. Right, thank you. Yes, sir.
Mr. Paulson volunteered that his client would be willing to plant some grasses and relocate the boat. Can we add those as conditions to this? Planting grasses in accordance with recommendations by staff or staff and VIMS.
You can do that, and he has a right to whether he agrees with it or not. Maker of the motion agree with adding that?
I would ask the client would he agree to it.
Well, that's something, officer, we're going to have to pursue.
Let's do this, though. From a formal perspective, Mr. Holland, would you agree to make that as part of your motion?
Yes, I will.
Seconder, agree with
yes.
that? Okay. Okay. No, it's not too late. Mr. McCluskey.
I notice on your plat, also that your client's plat, you have two storm drains running directly overboard.
Sir, I'm sorry.
Two storm drains running overboard. Here, so those easements, that's what they are. Would your client consider making this a project a BMP, whether it's best management practice, so that you retain any predatory as much upland silt from running into the water than it probably does today?
Well,
be a model for the community.
Okay. Only thing I can say, as I tried to convey, and apparently unsuccessfully, this particular developer has done a lot of, with the developments that it's had, it's been first class, the things that it has done. I noticed down there on one drain, and Mr. Davis can comment on it, and this is between one and two, or in that area, two or three, there is an old ditch there that has probably been there by 300 years, from best I can tell, and looking at trees growing in it. The other two drains, I believe, come out of the existing pond fields.
We dug the pond there, so the water does run through there already. So we're already doing that.
It's already filtered.
Okay. Is it graded toward the pond? I was looking at the easement between 5 and 6.
Okay.
And 7.
Mr. Paulson, let me make one more comment. You just said you basically critiqued your, as I took your performance, what you did today, and all due respect, you did a wonderful job. You just didn't have much to work with.
I would agree, Commissioner.
The next item on the, Carl, get in touch with you.
Okay, fine.
The next item on the agenda, and this will be the last one before we break for lunch, York River Yacht Haven Association 07-2052. Thank you, John.
Thank you, John. See you all. I think it's looking at more.